tuned. This KABU program has been made possible in part by KABU Foundation members and a grant from The Garden Spout, specializing in indoor gardening equipment, including horticultural lighting, environmental control, hydroponic and organic nutrients, and pest control. The Garden Spout is located at 4532 Southeast 63rd, just south of Foster in Portland. Information at 503-788-GROW. And now the Recovery Zone.
Hi, you're tuned to KBOO Portland. I'm Stephanie Potter, and this is The Recovery Zone, a show focused on healing our world. If we're going to heal our world, we're looking at probably the need, in fact, beyond probably, definitely, the need for systemic change. And my guests today have interviewed dozens of activists and artists and put together a book about what hinders and what fosters this kind of change. It's called When We Fight, We Win: 21st Century Social Movements and the Activists That Are Transforming Our World. To give you an idea about it, here's a quote from Kirkus Reviews. In addition to public education, the book highlights gay, prison, immigration, economic, and environmental activism, but one of its main lessons is that issues and answers are never confined to such neat categorical boxes. As the afterword by Antoine Darter summarizes, the underlying problem must be understood as racism in a capitalist society. The art is consistently and effectively provocative. Organizers will find much of this helpful and instructive. And there are a lot of other positive reviews, including from Noam Chomsky, Mumia Abu-Jamal, and others. The guests today are going to be Greg Jobin Leeds, Agit Arts, Jorge Diaz-Ortiz, and Osvaldo Boudet. And I wanted to let you know that they're also going to be later on this evening at the Reading Frenzy from 7 to 9 p.m., also with Change Lab Scott Nakagawa and poet and educator Walida Imarashi, and also another person from, it's called Ahi Arte, the artist that did this, Ahi Arte?
Ahi Arte.
Yeah. And they're all going to be there. There's going to be Stories, Art, Theater. That's tonight, Wednesday, January 27th at 3628 North Mississippi Avenue, 7 to 9 p.m. So anyway, I just want to welcome all of you here to KABU. Okay?
Thanks for having us.
Yeah. And we're just going to start with how this book got going. And I think actually that was you. You had this idea, Greg?
Yeah. So about 6 or 7 years ago, things were getting really rough in public education. We had I'd been a activist and a funder in public education for many years, a teacher. And as I watched things get worse and worse, I started wanting to see how successful past movements had gained traction. And I also wanted to interview folks who today are succeeding. And I just did this research, and I wrote a letter to some colleagues, and Jorge helped me edit that letter and just helped me really sharpen it up and get it crisp. And then over time, people started getting interested in more and asking me to talk about it and write about it. And so it eventually evolved into this book project and a real partnership with Ahi Arte, who I've been friends and supporting for over 20 years.
So basically from a letter to a book. and Jorge, you got involved as part of Ahi Arte. I'm going to keep saying that, I hope, right? And you live in Puerto Rico?
Yes, I live in Puerto Rico right now. And Ahi Arte was started in Massachusetts, in Lynn, a working class town to the north of Boston.
Oh, that's where it started.
And, yes.
And you yourself are an artist, a puppet maker, and you work with workers down in Puerto Rico now?
Yeah, I'm a puppeteer and mask maker and artist. I am the artistic director of Ahi Arte, and I also belong to a theater group in Puerto Rico called Papel Machete.
Uh-huh. And so how did you just were friends with Greg, and that's how you got going with this? Or what made you want to get involved with it?
Well, the friendship actually evolved out of work. So So a relationship starts with organizing work back in the early 90s through this organization called Neighbor to Neighbor. And it was through Neighbor to Neighbor that I started doing popular education, popular theater, exploring ways in which we could do work differently than when the way it was being done by most grassroots organizations, and really focusing on the cultural aspects and the art in the communities we were working in.
Yeah, I want to get definitely later to like why the art part is so important. And this book was packed with posters, comics, photographs. It showed street theater, music, bands. I mean, it was really like the art part of it was just so just gigantic and beautiful.
Yes, and I want to recognize Dea Hernandez's work on curating the artwork. She could not be with us today because she's sick, but she would be with us today talking about how she picked the art. And
yeah, that would be great to have known. Yeah, but she will be tonight at Reading Frenzy, so people can learn about it.
Yes, we hope that she will feel better and be with us tonight.
Great, okay. And finally, Osvaldo, how did you get hooked into all this?
Oh, that's a long story, but I started to work with Agitarte in 2003. Yeah, in 2003, and since there, I've been doing a lot of collaboration with the group. I'm part of Papel Machete too. Yeah, it's been a long way. I mean,
and what did you actually do with the book?
In the book, I've been documenting the process of the book tour. But I did photos for the book too. I have like two of the photos of the People's Climate March, a performance that Papel Machete did in the People's Climate March, and a big giant that we did with the community of Brooklyn with El Puente, and one of the photos that I took in the climate march is there.
Yeah. Uh-huh. And making videos, like I know it's on your website, there's videos of different people that were interviewed and you did some of those.
Yeah, I've been doing interviews and photograph and videos. Yeah,
great.
Yeah, he's got a great video of Mumia Abu-Jamal as Mumia is reading from jail his review of the book, and he has interviews with different folks who are in the book, so you get to hear and see them in front of you and in the video, where so it works well as a compliment against the book.
I like the woman from Song.
Paulina Helms-Hernandez.
Yeah. And she became this very vivid person for me, you know. That was a group, by the way. What was Song about? It was down in North Carolina.
So Southerners on New Ground, yes, they led a fight in North Carolina to stop a defensive marriage bill that was going on. They lost that battle. But in the process, they organized, they had over 1,000 conversations across the state of North Carolina, and were organizing many queer immigrant youth. And they got more and more involved in the whole immigration fights. And these dreamers, you know, would march with their T-shirts saying undocumented and unafraid, and created there's a huge march that we document in the book also that goes from Miami to Washington, D.C., and just very powerful. The Dreamers were able to, they finally, when they got to Washington and then across the country, many of the Dreamers occupied President Obama's campaign reelection office in 2012, saying they would not leave until the president fulfilled his earlier campaign promises and to push through immigration reform. They refused to leave, and that was finally what got the president to fulfill his commitments, because otherwise it would have been such an embarrassment to the president.
Right, and for to fail on the marriage thing, but to actually have all those conversations and stuff, you could count that as a success then, basically, right?
Yeah, well, that's what when we talk about when we fight, we win. Steve Meacham from City Life, Jorge is the one who brought us the title and the phrase from the work he was doing with City Life, an anti-gentrification campaign in Boston. And I hear you guys have incredible anti-gentrification fights going on here in Portland as well. But Steve says we don't win every fight, but when we fight, we win our humanity, we win the ability to build community with others, and these conversations that they had, people as they have these conversations, as they are getting out there, you're not only building community, but also you're developing your analysis, and it makes you feel connected to a much larger we.
Right. Yeah. And that's part of the whole we of the title. I'll get to that in a second, but the collaboration process that you went through, I'm assuming that you didn't always agree on everything?
We agreed on everything.
I mean, how did that go?
Now, what part? I mean, what do you...
Well, I mean, like, for instance, the title. I noticed, maybe it was something I saw online or somewhere. In the beginning, I think, Greg, you didn't really want that title or you were hesitant about it, but others of you wanted that title, When We Fight, We Win. How did that go? Or maybe I'm wrong.
In terms of the title, I'm much more interested in the content. I think Greg wanted to put out a positive message with the book, and so working with that within that, I thought it was a better title than some of the other options, like Transformers, which sounds like, you know, like a...
Yeah, like a toy.
Like a toy that was really cool, but, you know, nothing to do with social movements. And I think for, you know, one of the things that definitely it's a struggle in terms, not necessarily the book, but the whole, all these movements, and a lot of times, fortunately, we are constrained by nonprofits in the field, is that we shy away from talking about, you know, ideology. So I think it's hard to capture. So I think the title is good if we look at it as a motivation to, you know, to look into it and to get the book, but also very, very clear that when we're talking about winning, we're talking about, you know, exactly what Greg was talking about, which is a win every battle, but that we must fight to be able to develop the kind of, you know, organizations and strength that we're going to need to be able to change this world. Because I feel we're actually losing, you know, we're losing ground in many areas and we're losing many of the battles. And certainly as I go through these cities, I see, you know, the conditions of people of color in these cities, and the amount of homelessness and the gentrification and working class people not being able to live in these cities that we had a space in just a couple of years ago. So it's very dramatic what is happening. So in a way also the title is an invitation for folks to organize, and that's what I think the title is good at, but not as an easy solution, not as an easy...
Right. It's like, thing. Get out of your comfort zone. I saw that with the title, and that's definitely what you're talking about. You gotta get off the couch and do something, basically.
And in the process of doing that, even when you lose, you empower yourself and empower your communities. Like, we have to fight because we have no other option. Like, no fighting is going to let you to lose. At least when we fight, we have the possibility of winning.
Yeah. And this is what persuaded you, Greg, to go with the title.
Yeah, it you know, once at a certain point it became so obvious that this was the right title and it was so perfect, and it also comes, and I think it does get to this point that Jorge talks about ideology as well, because, as you know, we come from very different perspectives. And very different experiences, Jorge and I and Osvaldo. And, you know, here I'm both in the U.S. I would be technically considered part of the 1%. And, you know,
middle-aged so being, white guy.
Yeah, right. So I have a certain, I'm don't get to have many of the experiences, so I get to hear the experiences, but I don't get to have them in the same way that Jorge is having them, that Day is, that Osvaldo, that so many of the folks interviewed in the book are having them. So the language that comes out from folks who are fighting on the front lines is often much more powerful and much stronger, and they're much more quickly and easily talking about capitalism, they're talking about white supremacy. So they're using concepts that I get, but I would normally kind of want to go explain them and put it out to the audience in a certain way. Right. And so it's been really a powerful collaboration in that way, but also obviously a struggle as we engage in it. And it's I've learned about the concept of solidarity, about how do we create this mutual community together? And yeah, it's been a beautiful process.
It's good. It's good. And actually, I don't feel the brunt of it myself. You know, same thing. I suppose maybe as a woman somewhat, but
right.
But white there is privilege in that. And reading your book was, in a way, it was really slamming it home for me how much that is really part of my experience, you know, and how I need to, I don't know, it's like how to really get it. I just saw this thing on YouTube about a guy who started a slave museum in the South, and it was just incredible just to get it again, how awful that was, you know. Anyway.
Well, and then in terms of the slave museum, you know, it's pretty amazing that the United States does not have any museums documenting American slavery. There's some on African American culture. There's none on the Native American genocide.
Right.
And so, whereas, you know, both my parents escaped Nazi Germany, which is part of the pain and the experiences I have of refugees and jailing. But there's many museums about the Holocaust. The Germans lost the war, but there's not one museum in the U.S., I believe. It sounds like one might be started now.
Yeah, he started about 8 years ago, and he's already spent a ton of money on it, and it's transformed him, basically, is what he's saying. He's a rich white guy, and it's amazing. Anyway, I want to just let listeners know you're tuned to KBOO Portland on the Recovery Zone, and today's guests are Greg Jobin-Leeds and Ahi Arte, Jorge Diaz-Ortiz and Osvaldo Boudet. And they put together a book called When We Fight, We Win. And later this evening, they'll be at the Reading Frenzy from 7 to 9 p.m. Also with Day Hernandez and Change Lab Scott Nakagawa and poet and educator Walido Imarisha. And it's going to be a multimedia evening full of stories, art, and theater tonight, Wednesday, January 27th, 3628 North Mississippi Avenue, Portland, 7 to 9 at the Reading Frenzy. And also, if you'd like to call into KBOO now and talk or ask a question, the number is 503-231-8187. And I want to get back to the whole thing with art again. And as I said, the book was just jammed with photos and posters and infographics and a lot of reference to music and storytelling. And just what makes art so important to activism? And maybe you could start with that.
Well, I mean, it's interesting that you were all talking about, really you were talking about ideology before you made the station announcement. And and this is no light thing. I mean, and we talk about even just how we elevate the level of discourse and trying to get to a level of, you know, discussion that can even begin to define the relationships that we're talking about. So, for example, you talk about white privilege. The real problem is white supremacy. So, I mean, and we talk about, same thing, we talk about racism, but the real problem is white supremacy. You know, people talk about neoliberalism, or they talk about privatization, but the real problem is, you know, capitalism and imperialism. So I think art and the people that are in the book use art to try to, in a way, elevate that level of discussion, because we are so surrounded by these discourses. And Greg very well mentioned, for example, the experience of Jewish people is very known in the U.S. There's many movies. There's even, you know, science fiction movies about it, you know. There's real movies. There's documentaries. But there isn't about the terrible U.S. imperialism towards the Caribbean, for example. People don't know the story of the Caribbean or even where we are located, when the U.S. and its imperialism would be impossible without the Caribbean and the exploitation of our people. So in terms of art and cultural work, we get asked a lot about this question, why is it important? And it's a very difficult question for me to answer, because I don't see it any other way. I can't see any other way of doing the work without the cultural, you know. I mean, if we had the power, we would have radio shows, TV stations, books. You know, we would have our own, very different than they do, version of Disney, which would be anti-racist and anti-patriarchal, you know, anti-homophobic, and where, like, women would be complete and not waiting for their prince, or having to be the opposite, be a male role to then be successful. So all this relates to this concept of hegemony, which we talk about a little bit in our book, without trying to be, you know, going really deep into it, but we must start talking about the incredible ability that the U.S. has had, you know, with its imperialist structures, with civic structures, its educational structures, to be able to put out a very deep concept and idea of what an American is, or what the U.S. is. And I think this is when I hear a lot of white people talk about, you know, the privilege and so on. I think it's related to that deep cultural grounding that there is in this country, that people participate in and people in a way or another feel part of it. And I just give you a quick example. People say, oh, we invaded Iraq. I look at people who say this comment, like they somehow own up to U.S. imperialism, or somehow they have this ability to invade countries. But, you know, but this kind of thinking, this deep thinking of freedom and this deep thinking that the U.S. has, that they're the center of the world, I think it relates deeply to the cultural work that we're trying to combat against. And if you look at the artists in the book, you see people who are really putting out very strong messages with their art, sometimes prettier than others, sometimes more attractive than others, but really trying to put out an alternative to the horrible cultural expressions that we must survive every day, from advertising to educational institutions.
And it crosses boundaries of status, was what one person said. It crosses boundaries of gender, race, location, nationality. I mean, it really gets into you, is what I was sort of feeling, you know.
And in the end of the book, there's the designer's note at the end where they really talk quite clearly and eloquently about hegemony, and it's just this incredible analysis that helps understand how pervasive the idea is that, you know, whiteness being the norm, and the idea, you know, even the ideas of it's our human nature to, you know, want to consume more and get on top of somebody else, you know. So these ideas that capitalism almost is a natural common sense when it's
survival of the fittest.
Yeah, that whole language, right? Which is, even survival of the fittest was, as one of our colleagues points out, was you know, written during an industrial era by a white man, and so the whole lens that it's a white European, so, you know, which doesn't mean it's wrong or bad, but it does have a limited perspective.
Right, and it seems like part of what it can do is it can really, like here in Portland, we had there was this fight against Shell sending, and it's again something we lost, but I think in a certain way we won, because they were trying to send ships up into the Antarctic, and a bunch of people calling themselves kayaktivists actually were all over the planet with these photos of themselves hanging from bridges saying no, and people in the water in their kayaks, and it was just incredible imagery. And that kind of imagery, like, I think really gets to people, you know. And it seems like that's partly what goes on. So it's like a... The other thing that I got with art is that it gets people kind of... It's fun, you know. Like, especially the theater and the stuff like that, it gets people really wanting to hook up with activists, basically. Have you experienced that?
Have we experienced people's excitement over the work that we do?
Yeah, or you just, you know, you're marching down that street with that giant puppet, 20 feet high, and there's just a lot of people, and the puppet is just this incredible thing. And this was the People's Climate March in 2014. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Isn't there just something incredibly, like gravity or magnetic, pulling people into being around that kind of energy?
I mean, I think that, you know, puppetry is, you know, it's definitely something that's been in our tradition for, you know, for thousands of years. So I think, humans connect to puppetry for many centuries. And that's something that I think it's interesting to look at from the perspective of creation and from the perspective of, you know, constructing objects that we use on stage. But I want to get back at something that Greg was saying, because I think we have to be clear about, you know, about when we're talking about art and we're talking about limitations of perspective, that this is really not about pluralism. It's not about lack of narratives, even though that's a problem. The problem is that, you know, it's not white privilege, it's white supremacy, because, you know, the problem that it creates is not a problem of perspective, it's a problem of survival. I mean, this is really about people's survival, you know. Trans women are getting killed, you know, in the streets of the U.S. Black men are getting killed in the streets of the U.S. You know, our countries in the Caribbean have been exploited for ages, where women have been sterilized as part of eugenic programs, you know, and experimentations with our people, transplanting cancer in the 30s by the U.S. government. I mean, these are not issues of perspective. And in a way, it's interesting that we're still fighting for perspective and space to even talk about these issues, because this is about survival. Right. And this is how I see it. And yes, I can sit here and I have this, I'm you know, lucky enough to be sitting here and be able to talk about this and been able to explore it. But I've been exploring it as part of struggle, as part of a survival of my own humanity and my own sanity to be able to continue in this work. And that's, I think, very important, because as we talked about, folks out there, people of color are very clear. When you meet in the communities, when you meet in the work, when you meet organizers, when you meet folks that are doing the activist work, you look at each other and you know, folks know what it takes to survive and how hard it is to even be able to continue doing this work and to maintain that. So again, coming back to the cultural expressions and art of it, since that's the focus that we're taking in this particular component of the book, because I don't think art is the only important part.
Right.
But since we're talking about art and culture, if we go back to the producers of this art and culture, we look at the deep grounding that they have and how that comes out in the work. And that's why the work is so powerful. So yeah, and it can be fun after that, but the power of the work comes from the genuineness of the artists that are doing it and from their struggles and what they have to do to be able to survive and to be able to even do this work. And the amount of difficulty that it takes to do cultural work and cultural production and to be able to put out this art out, and even in the movements that in a way recognize the work, but a lot of times it seems like an adornment or a secondary thing.
Right, right. So it's like, it's serious is what I'm hearing. It's really, really serious.
Serious to me. You know, yeah. And sometimes it's like, oh, you're a puppeteer. It sounds like a cute thing, yeah. I don't know. It's hard to describe, but I think it's much more about us trying to reclaim some power on the streets, and we'd use all our, all that we'd have possible to do it. And right. Puppetry is one of the instruments that we had, yeah. But we want to use.
And like you all say, like if you could have been in the media, if you could have had your own television shows, if advertising and stuff would like bring that out, you know, there might be other ways that you'd go, but this is a way that you can totally go. You know, you've got and you can make that happen.
We use the access that we have to things,
exactly.
Right? And that's based on our capacity and our economic ability to be able to put out our message and our work.
Yeah, a puppet is just newspaper and paint, basically.
That's right.
Right. You also talked about the root causes, and through the whole book, racism, capitalism. Each chapter was about a different movement, immigration or education or incarceration, but racism and capitalism were just hitting or involved in every single aspect of every single movement.
Yeah, it is. And when we talk about climate change, for example, the book talk about climate change and climate activists, climate change is about racism and is about capitalism. The people that exploit the earth are the white countries. I like Europe, the States, like 50% of the pollution of CO2 is like produced by the States, and we represent only 5% of the population of the earth. And the countries that do not have the money and didn't contaminate the earth with CO2 and are the countries that are going to pay that debt that is, you know, it's been. And that's white supremacy, and that's a product of capitalism.
Right, and actually, like speaking of that, like I love this Bill McKibben quote that, there was two quotes in there. One was that that zip cars and bicycles stop at the ghetto, you know?
Yeah, that was Antwi Akam, I believe, said that. Yeah,
and then the other one was, I think Bill McKibben said that, you know, if we started realizing the whole justice thing, if we changed how we did our energy to renewables, it would completely change the whole way that we, the structure of the economy and who's rich and who's powerful.
And it's a conception that, like, that people believe that, like, to be a, that we can change the policies, and we can, but we need to like organize, of course, and be on the street and march. But that idea of individualism, that capitalist.
All right, you system, just put a solar panel on your roof, and that solves.
Yeah, or changing my light bulbs. That really doesn't do anything.
Right. I mean, we got to change policies.
Policies. and through a revolutionary system, because capitalism is not going to bring a solution to climate change. It's not, because the system is based in exploitation. And
well, that was another quote. Capitalism, unfortunately, is a system that profits. People profit from pollution, basically.
And exploitation. I mean, this is a closed system. We can't exploit this system forever. You know, the resources are limited.
Exactly.
And capitalism promotes like growth and endless amount of resources, and that's impossible in this system. Yeah,
I mean, that's probably the basic problem with capitalism. It's an endlessly growing kind of deal.
Yeah,
yeah. But I know there are people working on changing our money system. I don't know if you guys have heard of like local exchange trading systems and that kind of thing. You didn't get into that in the book, but is that something that you're aware of or thinking about or
We did look at several different both co-op models and collaborative models, as well as we looked at a bunch of the different, like there's the Plenty, and I think in North Carolina, local monetary system, and there are a bunch out there. Again, you know, a lot of them are local, and they're, some people use the phrase prefiguring. You know, they're starting to look at how do we create the future economies now, even though we're living within a within a the confines of today.
Thanks.
Can we imagine the future? And then, you know, Antonia Dardair, who writes the afterword, as you mentioned, she talks often about that. We know we have to create a new economy. And we also know that we're going to have to do it as we go, because we're right now within the confines of the perspectives of living in this very oppressive capitalist economy.
I mean, I think it's an interesting point that you bring up, this idea of alternative economies or alternative currencies. And I think, I mean, there is great folks that can use that and experiment that. But going back to that, you know, idea, you know, where does the electric car stop, or where do the one of these green things stop in our neighborhoods? It's because folks are, again, this goes back to survival. So if you're trying to just work 12, 14, 16 hour days and trying to like
bring
you know, a family together, you know, sometimes these practices, these alternative practices are not accessible to you, and they're not accessible to most people in the country. Although at the same time, I must say, a lot of these practices have been done by our communities for years. I
mean, right. That
we
was
had
one of the
growing
posters.
Food. We always grew food in our community. Oh, yes, it's a great piece by Julio Salgado in the book that talks exactly about how communities of color have been doing these practices for years. And it's great that now it's in style in many places and all that, but a lot of times the problem we have, which relates again to capitalism and relates to the way, you know, the way we relate to capitalism, is that they get commodified. Right, so then we have the light bulb that's green,
right,
and we have the car that's green, that's hybrid, that saves you 20% on gas,
right, that costs you a fortune to buy.
It costs you a fortune to buy.
Yeah, exactly.
And again, going back to what you said, it's about policies and practices that have to come from governments that have the power to change that. And that's when it becomes heavy to discussion, that we're talking about fundamental change in this country.
Right. One quick break here. Again, we're getting at our break time, or not break time, you're tuned to the Recovery Zone on KBOO Portland. Today's guests are Greg Jobin Leeds and Ahi Artes Jorge Diaz Ortiz and Osvaldo Boudet. Later this evening, they'll be at the Reading Frenzy. That's from 7 to 9. And a few other people who are connected to this book will also be there, people that were interviewed and Day Hernandez, who was going to be here this morning. There's going to be multimedia evening full of stories, art, and theater, and that's tonight, Wednesday, January 27th at 3628 North Mississippi Avenue in Portland. And if you'd like to call into the station here and talk with these people who put together this book called When You Fight, You Win. Or When We Fight, sorry, not you. When We Fight, We Win. That's an important distinction. And the number here is 503-231-8187. And again, so root causes are huge, but interconnection was also a huge, huge part of what you talked about with these books. It's like, again, you had chapters about immigration or chapters about and the environment or chapters about education, but each of those are the LGBTQ movement, and each of those was its own thing, but it was also very much linked to the others. For instance, there's over and over again, I kept reading the school to prison pipeline, for instance. Could you talk some about the whole interconnection of all this?
Sure. I think almost in any single story, you can see the interconnection, and people often come to some of our events and they say, oh, well, I want to get involved, but I'm not sure where to start. And I often say, it doesn't really matter how you get in, because as long as you're getting in with people who see root causes, and then all the paths are going to lead to the same place. And what I mean by that is, you know, just take what's happening in Flint right now, right? With the poisoning of our children, of the folks there, with the lead poisoning going on in the water. And so you can see in that, you know, you can see that, well, and, you know, Jorge keeps using the phrase white supremacy. You can see that it's okay to do that, or it's not as big a deal if you do that to black and brown people, or if you do it to poor people. And so you're doing it as part of our economic system. You can see it in the, some people call that the eco-apartheid, or what Osvaldo was just talking about who takes the brunt of our climate destruction. Right. It's generally going to be the poor and the people of color. And in each of the stories, they all eventually point to the root causes, and I think that's part of the interconnection. So root causes being the racism or white supremacy, being our capitalist economy, this economy, or as Fabiana Rodriguez, who is incredible art here, but I marched with her at the Climate March. A lot of her work is on fighting patriarchy. A lot of her work is creating images for the immigration struggles. But she's there at the Climate March, as so many people from different movements were there. And she talks about the extractive economy, and that we're just trying to, this economy that rewards you for extracting as much from everybody who works from you, or extracting as much from the land, no matter what the cost.
That's great.
And so, and as opposed to having a generative economy. And so you're imagining an economy that generates, that is life-giving, that is life-affirming, versus the extractive, which, she talked about the rape and take culture, versus the create and produce and nurturing culture. So, and I'd say there's one other root cause or interconnection that weaves it all together, which is this culture of punishment and violence that we have seen become accelerated. I think, all these things were part of our culture since slavery, since the genocide of the Native Americans, but it's taken on a new acceleration now, this punishment and violence. And so that, when I started teaching, the U.S. was a world leader in high school graduation rates, and today we're the world leader in jails. And so
it's amazing.
It is quite amazing.
Jails. Yeah.
And it's so, which doesn't mean that we should go back to the 60s or, sorry, 70s, and that would make things all better. But no, because the 70s got us to where we are today. But it does mean that we are seeing this whole concept of that even people take it as much more natural, that, oh, well, the way you stop crime is by doing more punishment. But people like Walida Imarisha, who's going to be with us tonight at Reading Frenzy, she's helped really put out there that there's creating transformative justice. She has what's called a abolitionist vision, and which means abolishing all the root causes of why somebody would go to jail. As opposed to building jails, you look at all the ingredients or all the things that might make somebody end up in jail, whether it's racial profiling, sentencing, the school to prison pipeline, as you talked about, the lack of access to programs, drug treatment programs, healthcare programs, the lack of access to livable wages. So,
or even a home.
Yeah, or a home, right.
Yeah.
Because now poverty is being criminalized, right? So you don't have a home, so you're put in jail. And it's just so many of these forces that keep on compounding on each other. So, Walida is absolutely brilliant. Her art is brilliant. Her stories are brilliant. And she also has this book of called Octavia's Brood that she co-edited, of science fiction stories all in the social justice movement. And it allows people to imagine different futures and to talk in different ways, just like I think a mask does, going back to the art. It allows one to say things in another voice. And Walida, I can't wait to be with her tonight at Reading Frenzy.
Yeah, Reading Frenzy. She will be there at Reading Frenzy tonight.
But Jorge, did you want to take a stab at that question?
What question?
we were talking basically about root causes and visions and the whole interconnection thing, basically, like how it is definitely all interconnected, all these different issues.
I think it's something that we've talked about a lot through the years, Greg and I. I mean, I mention it a lot because somehow interconnectedness for some folks seems to be a new thing, where we've always had complete visions. I mean, as a Caribbean person, as somebody who's been in Puerto Rico independence struggle for basically most of my life, It's like, you know, this interconnectedness with the how U.S. imperialism affects all aspects of our life, you know, and how the U.S. control of our borders, controls of our commerce, you know, control of our natality rates, you know, control of all the aspects of our life. They're all interconnectedness, so it's interconnected. And I think it goes back to this idea of, you know, nonprofits and single issue organizing and really, you know, what we talk about as the liberal progressive paradigm, you know, our ideology, that, you know, that everything is an issue that can be solved, because ultimately there's this belief that somehow this system will, will be fixed by fixing some issues, or it'll be just so much better, you know, right. And then we see, and it's true, there are certain things, and you'll see in the book, certain victories that are allowed in democracy, you know, certain victories, you know, that are important, like same-sex marriage. But we also see the other end of it, you know, the trans women of color talking about how their economic situation is horrendous and they can basically barely survive. Right. So you have the two ends of the spectrum, you know, and of course we want democratic gains like the ones the U.S. has seen in terms of equality in many, many areas. But we also see as that equality seems to get, you know, or we seem to have a more egalitarian society when we look at economics and look at the fundamental living conditions of people is only getting worse and worse.
Yeah, so. And actually, like, that was interesting how the LGBTQ movement is getting its marriage down, but it's not getting, as you said, people of color, transgenders, immigrants who are gay end up being thrown in jail. I mean, the interconnections of the suffering were just being brought out over and over again in this book.
Yes, and this is important because our brothers and sisters of color, you know, are definitely fighting for this, and you'll see it all through the book. And we just came from the Creating Change Conference, and, you know, there was the people of color there were very much, you know, up in arms because they had invited ICE to do a workshop, and they invited these Zionist organizations, you know, to come.
ICE is the Immigration Customs Enforcement.
Yes.
Oh, yeah. Oh, really? ICE invited them?
They invited them. So we have here forces, repressive forces to our community, which are invited to an event that's supposed to be about inclusion and about participation and about democracy. So, and this is where we have to be careful about perspectives and about pluralism and about, as you were talking at the beginning of the segment, of these, you know, terrorists that just got captured and one of them got killed, is that ideology is the
wildlife refuge.
Yes.
Yeah.
And then ideologies are the fundamental, you know, grounding of this, you know, our perspectives and what we, you know, we stand for. So we stand for love and liberation and inclusion, you know, and that has to be anti-imperialist and that has to be anti-capitalist and that has to be anti-patriarchal. And we're very clear about that because that's the only way to fulfill.
And anti-privatization.
Yes, that's why anti-capitalist is the larger. Just like we say anti-white supremacy because racism is a product of that, but white supremacy is a problem. Yes, privatization definitely has to.
Which is actually one of my issues with the whole Malheur thing. And I was going to ask you a little, like just comparing, like when we fight, we win. I think they are also sort of trying to take that on. But is there, there's a difference, isn't there? I mean, in terms of what you guys are doing and what the Malheur Wildlife Refuge, Ammon Bundy people are all about.
Yeah, I think, you know, it's pretty clear once you look at the messages that they're putting out versus the message that the folks in this book are putting out. And it's a very powerful difference where I believe the land that they are on was stolen land from Native Americans. It's they're pushing. You know, we are about people's self-determination, which they may claim that they are as well. But when you look at it and you break it down, that there's a very different spirit of a communalism that we have. That we have, you know, as Jorge said, and one of the mistakes I think Occupy Wall Street made that a lot of the other occupies did not make throughout, but was not to adopt an anti-oppression platform. And so it's really important that when we create these spaces, and this came out in this Creating Change conference that we were at in Chicago, a huge LGBTQ conference, but that you want to create spaces, or as one activist talked about, sanctuaries, you want to create spaces that are anti-capitalist, that are anti-racist, that are anti, you know, sexist, you know, so you want to be able to create that are going to be not tolerate any forms of oppression. Right. And that's not in terms of a political correctness, but it's in terms of a liberatory agenda.
Sounds good. Do you have any comments on that as well?
No, I just, not really. I mean, I have, the that situation is crazy, but it's a way to make, you know, public land private. But in another way, like having a reflection about racism in the States, I mean, that is a huge problem, and white supremacy. Those guys can be there only because they're white. Again, if I just can't imagine them be people of colors with weapons saying this land belongs to
us. I can talk. We can talk about the Black Panthers, right? Or we can talk about about the Puerto Ricans, who talk about the armed struggle for liberation.
I imagine that. Yeah, but how the government responds to our communities.
Right.
I mean, well, it is documented, right? And it's completely skewed and different. Yes. Anyway, I was just agreeing.
Right. The government doesn't call them terrorists, but if there are people of color,
even if they could call terrorists, they get treated very differently by the law. And this has been documented in the struggle of the Puerto Rican political prisoners and the freedom for Puerto Rican political prisoners, like Oscar Lopez Rivera, who's in jail right now. There's been analysis of the amount of sentences that our people got and compared to these white supremacist groups. And the U.S. and the federal government has allowed for the growth of these extreme right-wing and militia groups throughout the years because they did not crack down on it. Whether you look at the story of the Black Panthers and you see how they got killed for even carrying guns.
The young lords.
And it's not the same, because if we look also, again, going, you know, to Black liberation movements, and to, they started with self-defense. They started defending themselves against white supremacists. So it's not the same thing when a Black person takes up, you know, a gun in self-defense than when we have these extremists out there claiming some sort of concept of freedom that basically involves them taking over land for themselves.
For the extraction economy.
For an extractive, for capitalist economies, to some sort of, and justifying it to some freedom and anti-federal government, you know, discourse.
Very different. Again, I'm just going to pause here. This is our last 15 minutes. You're tuned to the Recovery Zone on KBOO Portland. Today's guests are Greg Jobin Leeds and Ahi Hartes.
Ahitarte.
My Spanish is no good.
It's okay,
Jorge Diaz-Ortiz and Oswald Butte. And Daymeyer Hernandez was going to be here, but she will be with them at the Reading Frenzy tonight from 7 to 9 p.m. There will also be Change Lab Scott Nakagawa and poet and educator Walida Imarisha. And they'll be there, and it's going to be a multimedia evening full of stories, art, theater, tonight, Wednesday, January 27th, 3628 North Mississippi Avenue. And if you'd like to call in the last 15 minutes here, the number here is 503-231-8187.
And book events do start pretty sharp on time.
On time, so be there.
It's 7:05, so we will,
is it,
the
be there
show
or
will
be
get.
Square.
We want to see you there.
Even if you're square.
Okay, and so I have all these other questions. Why don't you just talk about some of the things that make a movement work? Because that was a part of your book, just if you can.
Sure. And you know, there were, one of the questions that we asked at the end of each interview was, what are the lessons that you'd want to pass on to organizers, to people, activists who want to get involved? And so there's a handful of them came up, and I think we've actually talked about them all. And I think in a lot of ways, it's best to come, that they come out of the stories and out of the reality and out of the practice. And while I love lists, and I'm an American, and we like, you know, okay, here are the five, you know, five ways to insta movement, right? You just do these five
organizing
ways.
Organizing self-help.
And so, you know, it's, you know, these self-help books, right? You know, you can have five ways, the seven ways. So Jorge makes fun of me for it, and it's of having these lists, and it's not more than making fun. I think he's actually has he challenges the idea of lists. So,
part of,
but
your collaboration,
I'll just,
process.
Yes.
Oh, no, we have lists. It's just you know, just trying to like break this down sometimes to formulas a little different.
Yeah.
I mean, a little difficult. And I think some people will do a really good job at it, and I think Greg picks up some good points at it. But I think the essence of the book is the stories, as Greg says, and I think definitely,
and
the artwork, and it comes out in the book, and it comes out through the stories of the people, you know, that are interviewed in the book.
And it's something that's constant in the movement is that it's a lot of ways. It's a lot of ways to do stuff too. I mean, we can follow a list of how to be successful in movement because it's so many different lists.
Right.
So many diverse ways to do
things. Well, and it's changing the culture somehow seems a huge part of it. And how does that happen? And like, for instance, the gay movement did suddenly go from, like, when you were writing the book, there was no gay marriage, and suddenly now there's gay marriage in the entire country. How does that kind of, most of it, How does it just changing people's heads is just so incredible to me, and how that works, you know?
So, you know, I mean, you know, we all often forget that many people, and it's told in the book, the story is that many people point to the Stonewall riots as the beginning of the LGBTQ movement, and that was mostly trans, drag queens, people of color who were tired of being harassed by the police, and it was an anti-police brutality riot against in New York, and that was the birth of the movement. Many people point to, a lot of people also point to the AIDS epidemic, where yeah. again people's lives were not being valued, and the, you know, queer lives did not matter. And so you have these many, and also another force that people point to about why that movement really moved forward quickly was a lot of lesbian moms starting families. So those are some of the things that we've heard. But along the way, that movement, as well as all the other movements, did a bunch of different things, and we try to shape each chapter around one of these qualities. But I'll share a few of the qualities that that spoke to me, okay. and that we one is the is to tell your story. And that people, you know, the immigrant movement has been incredible at it. The LGBTQ movement has been, the AIDS epidemic allowed people to tell their stories in a way and get it out there. And so the art and the stories in the book really help document how to tell your stories and the importance of telling stories. Second quality is that all the movements, you talked earlier before we went on air about the North Star, all the movements have visions of transformation in
huge
some
visions.
Incredible visions that are really beautiful, that they point to something much larger, and they that it includes both personal transformation, it includes visions of organizational transformation, cultural transformation, structural or political transformation, and it's just incredible, powerful visions.
Yeah,
in there.
Like ending jails, or the group down in LA that wants to abolish all cars in LA.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, these visions are just so out there and so beautiful. Yeah.
And then a third one is that, you know, as we talked about going to root causes, that transformative organizing always has people addressing root causes. And the last one is disrupt power.
Uh-huh.
That it's been a key ingredient.
The fight part.
Yes, that's the win. And it's the we also, and it's the fight. It's the when we fight, we win. But it's disrupting power, but not just to disrupt power, but it's to change who has it and how power is held. So that's part of the vision too, and where each of these pieces are interconnected.
And that goes also with the whole thing with leaders in these organizations. I mean, there are leaders like Bill McKibben or something, but there's sort of some notion that in a certain way, everyone can take on that leadership capacity in whatever it is that they're like really gung-ho about. And that's really encouraged. Did you get a sense of that?
Yeah, well, I mean, definitely, I like the line that we need leader-full movements as opposed to leaderless movements. And that...
Yeah.
Often, many people have more of the opportunity, you know, when you get back to white privilege, you know, there's many more times when a white man is going to have the opportunity to practice leadership. And so the importance of both stepping up and also stepping back and to create those leaderful movements.
And you guys, like, so you guys are like leaders, too, in the way that you're doing things?
Yeah, we are, but our path to be leaders is really difficult because I've been trained to not be a leader.
Right.
I've been trained as a man of color in that grew up in a colony of the States to be submissive and not to rebel. And my struggle to be a leader is being a struggle of changing who I am and who I've been trained to be.
Was like self-transformation was another part of all this, I noticed.
Yeah, of course. I mean, we have to take individual actions to be able to be collective, of course, yeah. But that's it's not one way to do it. I say it again because diversity is really important. I mean, it's so many ways to transform the world. I mean, and it's no one way neither. We have to try to, you know, work at... to you know to do it in different ways and
Right, yeah. Right. And just stepping up in front of a microphone isn't necessarily the point of it yet. You know, I mean, it's like some kind of, you know, making a work of art or writing a book or, you know, even like there's a lot of different ways that this is happening. And it seems like just being part of a huge parade can be huge, you know. And but it's basically to get involved is what I was, you know, getting the sense all through too. You know, find what your niche is, what you're interested in, and just hook into it, right? And I guess the other thing, that one last little part of all this was that you talked about this time right now, you know, the 21st century, 2016 is a really pivotal time. And how so? Like, in terms of all these movements, like, and as Jorge's saying, you look around, things seem to be actually getting worse in a lot of ways. There's more CO2 in the atmosphere every day. People are being run out of the cities and into the suburbs, where it's like harder to get around and do things. Gentrification, poverty, jails. What's pivotal, and where are we at with this?
Well, both my parents escaped Nazi Germany, and they, during that time, my father, he was the last Jew in his school, in his high school in Hamburg, Germany, and he managed to escape. My mother was a refugee two times, and I tell the story because he in 2002, as the buildup to the Iraq War, as we lost many of our civil liberties, and this was after the invasion of Afghanistan, he said, you know, this is how it all starts. And he had watched the downfall of that country. And he wasn't pointing to the saying that we are the same as Nazi Germany in the 1940s with the death camps, but he was saying there's a lot of the signs that are there. Many others since that 2002 have seen it. You know, we look at the NSA spying and so much else going on, and so I think we are at a pivotal moment, and we have a choice as a country. And you know, we can go the directions of the Donald Trumps, you know, who want to deport more and create more hate and more anger, and or we can all stand up and fight back. And so it requires that we all get in and that we participate.
Well, I mean, I can't remember a moment that wasn't pivotal in my life. And yeah. I can't also remember a moment where our people have not been targeted. You know, we've been victims of COINTELPRO much before NSA was even a concept. And COINTELPRO was a counterintelligence program, very famous for persecuting Black and Puerto Rican and other, you know, and the AIM movement, Native American and other radical white groups in the United States of the 70s and 80s, 60s, 70s and 80s. So, I mean, so I think this pivotal thing, I think it's people like to frame things with a certain, you know, like idea that now it's different and this is the moment.
Yeah.
But this is a long struggle, and we have to look at it that way. And, you know, and this is the acceleration of something that's been happening for a very long time.
Yeah, it's getting faster and crazier, but it's been going on, as you say, probably since.
It's been very fast. Yeah. It's going to continue to be fast unless we can have a real shift, fundamental shift in our society.
Okay, so we just got 1 minute left. Is there any last comments you'd like to make, just in 10, 20 seconds?
So I wanted to make sure everybody knew about our website, whenwefightwewin.com, and you can see a bunch of Osvaldo's videos there, as well as there's a teaching guide and a lot of great resources that Day's been putting out there. And that's whenwefightwewin.com. And come visit us tonight at the Reading Frenzy at 7 p.m. in Portland.
Yeah, the Reading Frenzy. That's going to be at 3628 North Mississippi Avenue tonight. And there's going to be music, stories, art, theater, multimedia evening. And everyone's sitting at this table, and a lot more people are going to be there as well.
And you get to meet my teachers, Jorge, who's here, Walita, Imarisha, Scott Nakagawa, and Osvaldo. And I just want to give a shout out and a thanks to Agitarte, who have just been incredible artists and collaborators, and really appreciate you having us on.
Great. Okay, so you've been listening to Greg Jobin-Leeds and Agitarte's Jorge Diaz-Ortiz.
Agitarte, Jorge Diaz-Ortiz, de Hernandez, Osvaldo Budet.
Okay, good. And this is the Recovery Zone on KBOO Portland. I'm Stephanie Potter. This is your all non-corporate alternative community radio station. And I just want to thank you all for listening.
Thanks, Stephanie.
Ciao.
Thank you.
Time for the KBOO News at noon for Wednesday, January 27th, 2016. Local shootout with occupiers in Eastern Oregon. The FBI and Oregon State Police stopped several vehicles outside Burns last night that contained occupiers from the National